after Public Radio asked me to try and record this one, so I just want to let you know in advance. So, especially because sometimes people ask me questions about legal issues during the Q&A on the talks about software patents. So, if you're in litigation with someone, and it would be a really bad idea for that, the details or whatever question, you probably shouldn't ask it in a large group of people anyway, but you especially shouldn't ask it when we're going to put it on the internet for Hacker Public Radio. So, that's the full disclaimer there so everybody knows. I'm going to go ahead and get started. Basically, I'm going to talk about software patents, what's going on. I'm pretty focused on the U.S., that's why we're here, but it's also where all the software patents are coming from. Well, not all, but a lot. The lion's share, for certain, and the lion's share of the software patent suits. So, if you have questions about the situation in other countries, sometimes I can answer that, but we're going to focus pretty hard on the U.S. So, which direction am I going? Okay, so first we're going to talk kind of about where patents come from, how did we end up with software patents in particular? And so, it's important to kind of think of the idea of innovation first. So we have this idea, you know, that's like one of those buzzwords, right? Like, oh, we're thinking outside the box and pushing the envelope and all of that jazz because we're innovative. And so that word just kind of means, it has like novo, which means new in it. And so it usually means like, you know, putting something new in. And so, you know, that could mean a couple of different things, but I think when we're talking about policy, it's important to think about, are we talking about something that's actually a new idea, like a new, you know, process, product, machine, etc., or are we talking about a new way to monetize or a new way to think about an idea? So, like, one is very concrete, and, you know, inventions are great. I remain hopeful for time travel, but monetizing, and I hate saying that word, but I want you all to be angry with me about it. So when we're just talking about a new way of thinking about things, then, you know, so innovation is good, but be clear on which part we're talking about. So to kind of further illuminate that, sorry. So the difference between patents and products or ideas, just to get a little bit further in. So like an innovative thinker might say, we could use a more efficient system to speed this up, like if we could improve the airflow. So that's a thought, right? Like, yeah, okay, cool. Like, you know, sometimes I'm in the supermarket and I'm like, this place would be great without all the other people, which is a thought. It's just a thought. It's not like I haven't implemented anything. A product is if you actually build something that's more aerodynamic. So then you have like a new, more aerodynamic version of the device, or like a supermarket with little holes on the outside so you don't have to interact with the other people when you're in there or whatever. And then the person, the idea, says like, I feel like I could charge more if this thing went faster. So those are all like different separate concepts. Patents are supposed to be granted for things which are novel and non-obvious. And the U.S. Patent and Trade Office in this country is, I want to make sure I get this number correct, upwards of 40,000 new software patents each year. That's just the U.S. There are some in Europe, too. They have a lot less. So, and you're like, why so many? Because if you look at just like 10 years ago, it was half that. You go back to the 90s, it was like 5,000 a year. So, one of the huge problems that happened is a rise in what we call functional claiming. So you used to be able to like get a patent on, I built this specific thing to fix a problem. And that was what patents were traditionally granted for. What we're doing now is granting patents for, I have an idea about fixing a problem, comma, with software. So.
Sure, like intellectual property rights.
Right, so this isn't a general, patents are definitely part of what we call intellectual property, without getting into what's, I know, and you know, and we can talk about it later. Okay, so because of the funny dance that we do with what's patentable and what's not, while technically math is not supposed to be patentable, if you cloak it in a whole bunch of ideas about your goals and what you want to do with the math, it can still just be a bunch of like loops and lists and things that everybody uses. But if you hook it to your goal on what you want to accomplish, all of a sudden you've made a patentable thing. So that's where we went from 5,000 to 40,000 software patents per year from 1990 to today. So that's just a little bit about like how we got to there. It's also, I would say, the other thing about ideas is that it's harder to figure out when you've infringed. So if I have a patent on a chair or things you sit on, then if you sit on something, then you know you've infringed because it's right there. And that's sort of a really blatant example. But for an idea, like when does my idea hit your idea? So you can see how that gets like much fuzzier. It's almost impossible to write software and not infringe. So everyone is with me so far? Okay. I did tell you this one would be more depressing than this morning, right? Okay. So ideas. So more money, more problems. I'm going to move through this part pretty quickly so we can get to the solution part. Part three is solutions. And some of this stuff you already know. People have been reading like Grokla or Slashdot and sort of have a general idea that this is, I mean, I assume you're here because you're like, there's darn software patents, what's going on? Okay. So what you probably already know, patent suits are costing us a lot of money. We lose $80 billion annually to non-practicing entities or trolls. They actually have a preferred term, I guess, they like. We don't have to use it. But that's $80 billion that just goes down the drain, because those are our entities that are not like making a different version of the thing. They're just not making a thing. So everyone is clear on what a troll is? Okay. I can talk about that a lot. I'm really angry. So it's expensive. And I do want to point out that that isn't even including litigation between practicing entities. So there's the non-practicing entity where they're like, oh, I'll buy some patents and then I'll sue people who are actually doing things. Then there's the situation where one company says like, huh, you're like right in our space, and if we could sue you and get an injunction so that you would have to stop sending your software out, we would have a total competitive advantage because you'd be stuck and tied up in the courts. So you see basically like anti-competitive suing, and that sort of activity is also expensive. The lawyers don't get any cheaper over there, so plenty of money over there. The activity is increasing and not decreasing. I think I have a couple of graphs on that in a bit. It's not spurring innovation. There's a couple of great examples of that. Let's see. So, I did put this up as a slide. I tried to trim this up a little bit, but there's the activity increasing. So these are patent suits involving non-practicing entities. A lot of this is not only software, but we are doing maybe like 4,500 software patent suits a year. This is just with companies that don't make anything. And a large percentage of this is software, because the software suits tend to be really successful because they go to a court where the person doesn't really understand software and they're like, yeah, it sounds like you guys did a lot of work and okay, sure, you can have money. Or worse, the company that they pick on to sue is like, we forgot to leave $5 million laying around for lawsuits, so okay, we'll just do a cross license at whatever price you name, crap. So that's a different thing, but let's see. So in addition to being expensive, software patent suits are also otherwise a pain in the ass. Sorry if anyone used the word ass, you haven't heard before. So thickets where like whole swaths, like whole general categories of software are so patent encumbered that you know, there's a, like a mafia-like presence, like a video is sort of this way. Rewriting code, if anyone remembers the file allocation table thing, it's like a piece in the Linux kernel that had to be rewritten because it infringed on Microsoft's amazing invention that sometimes you put the long name of the file and sometimes you use the short name. But it's pretty deep down in the kernel, so that had to be rewritten and was probably a pain in the you-know-what for whoever. You know, of course, it's just generally, like, it would be great if we could just go back to writing software and not worry about any of this at all. Some of the more recent developments that you may not have heard about, even if you were aware that this is a giant problem, is that the patent aggression entities are getting bigger. That's same as trolls for the most part. And the targets are getting smaller, some of them, not all of them. They still want someone with money, usually, but they found that they can get a settlement pretty quickly with some of the smaller targets. So they're targeting people that are not building software, but just making software. And then this is also a little bit, they're going after kind of stuff that's the stack versus the special sauce. So you see anti-competitive behavior hitting like whole categories of things, like tablets or phones, as opposed to like a phone that has one specific tiny feature among hundreds. So it's blocking innovation in the worst possible way. So now on to intellectual ventures. This is probably the largest troll, and I'm going to talk about them for a little bit. They have like 1,300 shell companies that people could find records on. So these are all individually incorporated, and they all act in concert. So there's a story of a guy in Russia, and he got a letter from one company that was like, hey, it looks like you might be using some stuff. Would you be interested in a cross license? Because we have a patent, and we could totally be buddies, and you could just send us little checks, and it'd be awesome. And he was like, But then got another letter from a different company, which happens to also be part of the same giant structure, but with different letterhead, different address, all of that jazz. And they were like, we're thinking about suing you because it looks like you're using our stuff. So it was like a little good cop, bad cop, except they're not police, they're just sending letters. And so he tried to send a letter to the FBI saying he thought he had encountered some kind of racketeering organization, which he did, but unfortunately they're incorporated and filled out all their paperwork, and so they're not, like, I mean, they're corrupt, but they're not technically a racketeering organization. The other thing that we do know about, not only intellectual ventures, but other ones like Acacia Technologies, they do regularly talk with each other. I don't know anyone who's ever been invited to these meetings, but it's not difficult to imagine some pretty terrible things that they might discuss at these meetings. Like, oh, how about you get that one, and then we'll come and clean up on them next month. It could happen. We don't know. There is also another pretty ridiculous example. Nathan Mervold, who's the man that owns Intellectual Ventures, someone wrote an expose saying, like, oh, isn't it interesting that this company you're on the board of just got a patent infringement notice from Intellectual Ventures? Ha, 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 ha. And then, like, it was reported in the news, and then, like, quietly that company got moved off of the patent infringement list. So we don't know, but it seems like this is so vast that he sued himself. So, you know, there's a lot of potential for grossness there. So, all right, so now we're sufficiently convinced that this is a gross practice. Okay. Let's go into, we did talk a little bit about how users rather than just producers of software are being sued, and then this is the number 40% of the time. Colleen Chen is over at UC Santa Clara Law and has been writing a lot of stuff, specifically looking at controls, but and you know, the whole kind of non-practicing entity thing, and I'll bring in some of her numbers later, but I think that the problem here is it's particularly troubling when you're looking at free software because, you know, we want to be able to say like, oh, you can use it and it's not, you know, patent encumbered and all these things. I mean, I'm sure everyone would like to say that about their software, but, you know, this is, it just is feeding into the FUD and confusion and, you know, it's, so I think this is worrisome in a separate way, so. Anyway, so let's get on to solutions. The great thing about like, so some of these really egregious things were like Nathan Revold sued himself or like, you know, seeing the big like telecom giants duke it out and have that stuff be in the news is that over the last year or two, especially, there's been like a huge pile of people, smart people like Kung Chen and we have like James Besson in Boston looking at this problem and trying to figure out like what kind of policy levers we could use to change this. So that's the bright spot in the sea of stuff. And I think the other thing that's interesting to note here is that we're not totally at sea. In software, we like to think like everything is new and nothing like this has ever happened before. But this, we have seen a situation before with what they called at the time patent speculation. So both with farm tools and then also with railroads, they had problems where patent speculators were buying patents on farm tools and railroad parts. I'm not that familiar with trains, which I'll see in a sec. They, you know, were suing railroads for using brakes on trains. and the railroad companies are like, you don't have any trains. What? Like, why are you sending it? Like, you can't have the patent on brakes for trains. Also, you can't have a train without brakes. Like, so that sort of motivated them to gather together as a community and figure out, like, you know, industry-wide, like, what can we do to keep from being sued by this guy who does not even have any trains on the concept of brakes on trains. The farm implement one was even kind of worse because it wasn't like, I mean, I'm not trying to gather a lot of like teary-eyed sympathy for railroad magnates, like I'm sure they were fine, but for the farm implements, people were coming by and they were like, oh, I see you have a hinge on your gate. You know who holds the patent on gate hinges? It's me. You know, and so like they were coming down and shaking down farmers out like at their farms, and people were like, what the, you would like hide your tools so that no one could come by and try and get you to pay royalties on something. So you know, maybe that it could be a little exaggerated, they didn't have TV or anything back then, so but this has happened before, so some of the scholarly thought process on this is not like based on like out of nothing. They're looking at what's worked historically before and what kinds of solutions we might be able to tailor for us today. So, all right. So, before we get into that, I want to talk about patentability and what's already on the books, because what I found over the last year of talking with people about these issues is that I would say, like, you know, blah, 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 and they're like, well, math just shouldn't be patentable. And I'm like, oh, it's not. And so, like, just to kind of get out of the way, like, what's already on the books, and then we can talk about improving or embroidering on that. Okay, so, patentability. It turns out that the current statute is actually not so bad if it was being followed through the law. So, the first bit, no math, and stuff has to be actually new and actually useful. So, you cannot, things like the idea of using magnets to help you sleep, because they don't do that, or any of that kind of thing. So stuff has to be actually new. You cannot patent math. So that is already on the books. So we don't need to pass a law that says you can't patent math. Novel. You can't patent something that people are already using. And this seems like it should be sort of like, of course, that's the point. It's supposed to be an invention, like a thing that didn't exist before. But the statute is very clear. If you see someone like, ooh, that's cool, I'm going to go patent it now because I just saw you selling it to other people, and then come back and shake you down for money. You're already not supposed to be able to do that, so, which is that's heartening. Non-obvious, so it can't be obvious to someone in that field. Has anyone here ever made a basket? Yes. Okay. Oh, I love the Pacific Northwest. I asked this in New England, and everyone's like, what? Like, sometimes you hear, like, underwater basket weaving. So if you've never made a basket, that sounds, like, crazy, right? Like, why would you get underwater to make a basket? It's not you, it's the basket that's underwater because it makes the strands pliable. So if you have never made a basket, underwater basket weaving might sound really innovative. Like, wow, that's a brand new thing. I never even thought about it. But if you've made a basket before, you know that the default is to do it underwater. So, yeah.
Can I patent weaving a basket under salt water?
I don't think so. Also, I don't think you want salt because it makes the basket all crusty. You want a crusty basket. Not to, I don't want to disagree on that, but I don't know that we're having a lot of patents in the basket field right now, but that's a little outside the scope. Maybe someone will Wikipedia that and need to practice. So anyway, the stuff has to not, it has to be, it can't be obvious to someone in the field. So everyone's with me on the non-obvious. All right, and then, yes, it must actually have utility and be possible. Like, you can't, I'm trying to think, there was like a, someone had tried to get something like human flight without any devices patented at some point. And there's other ones that are like really nutso like that, but you can't patent something that is impossible, which seems, yeah?
Can you patent something you think might be possible with new technology?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was the thing. And that's kind of the whole problem with the software patents. You can patent stuff that, like, you don't know if it's possible.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I recall reading and hearing that Compton was going to patent genes of people or special biological.
Yeah, there's some reports about
that. Number two seemed like that would preclude someone going to
I'm using mine too. I think it's similar. I think they do a similar dance, linguistic dance, like people do with math when they're patenting software. So, like, you wouldn't say I patent math or I patent genes. You would say I patent genes when you do this thing with them, or when you use them like this, or when you look at them for this kind of research that maybe I put in a file allocation table or something. So I think they add some other verbiage around it that obscures the fact that they're just full-on patenting genes. But I'm not as knowledgeable in that part of patentability by a long, long, long shot. But I think there's some similar weaseliness happening. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, it doesn't have to work.
Oh yeah.
I patented an ice detector. And it doesn't work.
An ice detector?
For airplanes.
And it doesn't work. We talked about that. It doesn't have to actually currently work, but someone at the USPTO has to read it and be like, that could feasibly work one day. I mean, you can't just so unless you find someone who believes in leprechauns at the USPTO, you can't patent conversations with leprechauns. Yeah.
What burden of proof does an inventor or a patent seeker have to meet? What do they have to do to say this is actually possible?
Right.
So the short
and cynical answer is it just has to use a full patent examiner. The way that these are written, I'm talking to you in regular, normal people English. Patent applications are never written in that. I promise you. Like, it makes the eyes bleed to look at them. And sometimes if you want to, you can go and read things that have already been patented, and you'll see what I mean. Like, the amount of verbiage, there's a couple different problems, and I'll get to that actually a little bit later when we talk about ways that we might change how the U.S. Patent and Trade Office works, and you'll get a bit better sense of what the problem over there is. It's not it's not exactly that they're stupid, it's a little bit more of the overworked, underpaid thing. And so, yeah, we'll get to that for sure. Okay, so current statute, not too bad. So courts, we talked a little bit about courts already with the pharma stuff. There have already been some cases. The FSF was an amicus on the Bilski case, and we had high hopes, I worked there at the time, that the courts would take that opportunity to narrow the scope of patentability. That particular case was actually a business method patent, which is another kind of vague, doesn't seem like it ought to be patentable, abstract idea thing. But again, covered with verbiage to make it seem like a thing. There are many, many, many business method patents out in the world. So we had hopes that the Supreme Court at that time would choose to do something. They did not choose to do something with Bilski. And in fact, they wrote a long decision. One of the justices actually said, like, well, if we thought it was having a chilling effect on innovation, then we might be moved to do something about that. If. And I was like, where does that guy live? Oh, yeah, he's the Supreme Court of the U.S. He must live here. But clearly doesn't, well, I'm sure he doesn't read Glock law, but he should. That's the problem. But anyway, so that one was, that Bilski, a wash for the most part. There's like, they might have left a tiny crack of a door open without getting into too much. But another case that we had hoped would kind of also help to narrow the scope of patentability was the Prometheus case. And the courts did move a little bit like, hey, maybe we shouldn't have patents on absolutely everything. The Prometheus case is like a medical kind of procedure case. So it had, they had like a little bit more of a sympathetic face. They had like sick people who were actually dying because some large company was trying to get this tiny clinic to pay them money for a medical procedure which they had patented, which was basically like, you put the substance into the person, you measure it, and then you decide if they need more of the substance. That was the grand invention there. I'm sure it didn't read that way when they got the patent. But that was basically like, you know, you see if people have enough of the drug or if they're bigger or their metabolism is higher and they need more or something. So that was, they were like, no, you can't have a patent on that. So when there are like, when there's like sad, sick people on the short end of the stick, like the court can be moved. So, you know, that's good news, I guess. When we think about like going forward, as far as like a judicial solution to the patent problem, changes in the judicial system would have an impact on patents that have already been issued, and then also patents going forward. So that would be a big sweeping change in the scope of patentability. So, you know, but with great big change comes great big cost and great big pain in the you know what. The courts are really unlikely to do that, and we would need a really surgical strike kind of case, which means we would have to, or, you know, someone that was thinking clearly about this issue would have to bankroll a case, and they might have to bet on a couple of them and try and get one of those up to the Supreme Court and get them to make a decision. So Supreme Court, it would be like a huge sweeping change, but it would, you know, it would be a lot of work and it would take some time. So that's not to say don't do it. I just want to let you guys know. So some of the other ways that we could kind of change what goes on with the judicial, I think I have a list. Yeah, okay, it's a big, we know that. Okay, so one of the things that we could consider doing is finding a, like, some sort of a policy lever to lower the plaintiff's incentive to sue. And so they could set a lower precedent for the amount of damages awarded. So right now, you can, the lost sales rubric is kind of a mess. So like, you know, you have like a phone and you're like, oh, well, we sell that phone for like $500, which of course nobody does. You buy a contract and then you get it for another $70 or whatever. And the piece of the phone that we're suing you about is like maybe like 2% of what makes it awesome, you know, depending on what piece it is. But then after you get juries thinking and talking about this amazing invention for like 2 weeks or something, they allot a much larger percentage of the cost of the device or the product than is really necessary. So We are saying, like, if you can find, if you can get, like, a tiny piece of, like, a $500 device, then we might give you a large percentage of that for lost sales. So the courts could also choose to sort of lower the incentive by not awarding the lost sales thing in such a like, an egregious, over-the-top way. Another thing that Germany and France and the UK and Japan already do is they have an innocent user defense. So you, this would cut out the thing where you sue the person who's just using the software, but not, but it wouldn't do anything about people who are making software suing each other, or non-practicing entities suing people who are making software. But if you were suing someone who's like, I just bought software and we just use it, then you could say, we're not infringing because we're just using it. We're not, we didn't make it. So there's a couple of ways that we could sort of like make that giant pot of gold at the end of the court case a smaller, less exciting pot. Yeah.
So that last thing, for people who are doing open source and just giving it to other people,
there would be some downright sales. Well, so it depends on who is suing who, right? So, if a proprietary company that's offering a similar service or a product or functionality is selling theirs, then they can argue that your free software project is causing them to lose sales at whatever cost they sell it at, right? So they don't take your price. So like when Apple sues someone, they don't sue for Android prices, they sue for iPhone prices on lost sales. Does that make sense? Which is, you know, yeah.
Going after the end users be covered by a first sale doctrine?
What do you mean? First, I'm sorry.
First sale doctrine just basically says if you buy something in good faith,
oh,
you have the reasonable expectation that the person selling it has a right to sell it.
Right. So, so for the innocent user doctrine, this would be like not I don't think we're at the point where people who just buy a phone are doing that, but like a bank that outsources. So like, it's a little bit different. I think it's not covered in the same way. So they may have said like, can you customize this a little bit for us, even though they didn't build it in-house. So it's, but yeah, for the first sale thing, I think would still hold for like just a regular person who's purchased a phone. So just to be, and we're, I don't want to alarm people, like it's already bad enough without being, you're not going to get sued just for having a phone, or not any time that I know of. So, okay, so judicial solutions. So we could set precedent, or try and push them to set precedent that better upholds the existing statute, which we just read and is actually totally reasonable. And then, you know, again, we would have to push cases up and get better precedent set. We could try and get the push the courts to set precedent that treats software patents differently than other patents. Again, going through the courts, but so I don't know. Like, not all of these do I know how they would do. These are a lot of ideas, and I have opinions about some of them, and some of them are just like, huh. Well, you know, we'd have to look into that. So, I guess that was all I had put on. Okay. So, moving from judicial onto legislator. If people have questions about that previous section, but we will also try and leave questions at the end too. So, Congress. Could we get them to do something? yeah. Exactly. Actually, that's the next one. So we just talked about how expensive lawsuits are. Congress also ain't cheap. That said, sometimes they can be moved to do some. So some of the legislative solutions. Just a few years ago, we passed the America Invents Act, and that was meant to be this big overhaul of the whole patenting system. And some of the things in there were good, and some were not so good. Some of the good things were, it took tax methods, which is basically like, I patented an awesome way of cheating on my taxes out of the scope of patentability. they're like, wait a second, that's our money. No. You can have everyone else's, but not ours. So that was, I guess, a plus. We also got more opportunities for third party prior art submission, which means like the USPTO said, like, we would like to hear from people, like, it's come to our attention that maybe there are things we don't know. And we would like to give you guys more opportunities to school us on stuff. So, you know, so that's good. And then there's also more opportunities for post-grant opposition, which means, like, after a patent is issued, like, there are more, there's, like, a mechanism in place to be like, hey, wait, why'd you create that one? That's, but, you know, so not perfect, baby steps, right? And it also, we went from first to file to first to invent, which harmonizes the U.S. with the rest of the world. Usually the harmonizing is usually a bad thing. It usually means lowest common denominator, but this means that the patent gets granted to the first person to file the patent rather than the person who actually invented it. Unless you can find prior art and use that, you know, third-party prior art submission process. Stuff that it did not do, it did not change the funding structure of the U.S. Patent and Trade Office, which is sad, because right now they have a financial incentive to grant patents. So they get, like, you pay money when you apply for a patent, and then you pay more, like, if you get it, then it goes fees into the place that you work, so people tend to grant the patents. So the USPTO currently grants about 75% of the patents it receives. So. It's like working on commission at the mall. Someone asked me the last time I talked about this, like how much money we would need to fully fund the USPTO, and I don't know the answer to that.
Why don't you just raise the price of the application to the price up to 75% of the price of receiving?
Yeah. Raising the application price means that then you have more, like the wealthier players get more patents and the non-wealthy players don't get as many patents. So you already have, it sort of accentuates an imbalance. There are other ways, like doing a scaled structure of fees. So like if you're a person that has less than like 5 patents, then it doesn't cost you a lot extra. Like there's some other ideas about tinkering with the fee structure there.
What is the price of patent application?
I don't actually know that off the top of my head.
It is
a bunch. It's and you usually pay an attorney to prepare the patent for you. So it's like it's kind of a whole bundle, and it depends on. Yeah.
When I did my patent in the mid 1980s, it cost the Boeing company about $50,000.
Okay. Yeah. That's it might be a little more, might be a little less. Your mileage could vary, but yeah, it gets for me when it's like one of those big numbers. So yeah. Anyway, so, okay. So, other things, people are like, let's just get rid of software patents or patents altogether. Which, trying to get Congress to do that, this would be great because it would affect existing patents. It would also change the situation going forward. It could be really difficult to gain support for this because of the, certainly for patents altogether. You guys may be familiar with the pharmaceutical industry. So trying to get rid of patents altogether, it's sort of like, you know, to fix the patent troll problem. This would be like pissing off the Incredible Hulk while you're already sworn by tigers. So I think, like, unless you have a lot of, like, a ridiculous amount of money and you can just buy off the tigers and the Hulk all at once, I don't know what it would take to buy off Big Pharma. But more feasibly, getting rid of just software patents, but again, there's like a not small amount of money invested in the current system with software patents. So, you know, I'm not saying don't do it. I'm saying be aware that like you should try and invent something that makes you a lot of money first. That would be, anyway, so like some like the pure math patents are already not supposed to be granted. So like passing a law saying like you can't patent math is of course not so useful. We could also make the plaintiff pay the legal fees. So this is saving. This is one of those backer notes where someone came up with a password and how to saving high tech innovators from egregious legal disputes. Right? No, so the name is Gufia, but basically this it would make the plaintiff pay if they lose. And the idea of this, which is not passed, it's just a proposed law, is that a lot of the troll suits are just settled because and they lose a lot too. So like they just kind of play the odds and they're okay with losing a bunch. But if trolls had to pay the legal fees of the person they sued every time they lost, then they would at least be pickier about who they sued. So that's of like some utility, I guess. But it certainly is not a sweeping change, but it's it could be worth doing with the right kinds of things in place. It could also, if it was written poorly or broadly applied, it could end up also kind of hurting worthy litigants where someone like just full on did actually steal your idea and you're both practicing entities. So. So that would just have to be worded carefully, is all I'm saying. Legislative solutions. People feel like Congress is gonna, I don't know. you fill in the blank on that. Oh, and then we're talking about with fees, so like we could raise the maintenance fees on patents. So like one of the huge problems with software patents that they last for 20 years with like some limited option to to extend them. If you keep a patent going, like you have to pay what's called a maintenance fee. So we could kind of make the maintenance fee like astronomical so that you would have a software patent that you could use for a couple of years, and then whenever we decided it was kind of like really stupid for you to continue to have a patent because it's on software and the world moves by at a fast pace, the maintenance fees could go up to maybe discourage the use of those. Yeah.
Is there a renewal cap?
Like how many times you can renew?
Yeah.
You have to do something to get it there, but I don't know if there is a cap, but it does involve...
You have to kind of defend your...
You have to, like, there is an interaction that you have to have with the U.S. Patent and Trade Office to, like, extend. It's, and you have to pay, like, more fees to them. And again, I'm sorry, I don't have, like, super, I'll have some more, like, some exciting more reading for you guys if you want. And again, this is an idea that's been floated. This is not a proposed legislation. This is just an academic paper where someone's like, maybe this would work. So I'm sorry if it doesn't have as many numbers on it. But
I know on trademark that it's every 3 years or every 5 years. It's almost a reapplication process, but you have to prove that you're continuing to use it.
Right. So there's some work and some. Yeah, for software, like the initial 20 years, like most solutions are focused on that because that's the real problem, is the initial 20 years is pretty egregious for software.
That's longer than most software companies last.
So it's good. All right, so legislative. So the next part we're going to talk about is potential policy changes. So. Presumably people work for the government and like many of them are employed to try and make businesses go and make things work. So on the plus side, some of these could be relatively quick to implement. So policy changes at the USPTO or maybe another government agency, like we would just have to convince the agency that they wanted to make a policy change. Most of those would likely only affect patents going forward. So we'd still have like the 20 years of everything that's current, like right now. So the 40,000 a year, like all of those patents would still be around if we pursue a policy solution. All of these have their pluses and minuses. Probably what will work the best is some combination of different things. So could we make the USPTO enforce the existing statute in a helpful way? That's the crux of the ideas behind these types of solutions. So require written descriptions and definiteness. That means not just saying what the invention is, but showing exactly how it will be implemented. So getting rid of all that kind of functional claiming that's like, I have a dream about software. No, you can't have that. Definiteness is another thing that, it means like clearly prescribing the boundaries of the patent. So instead of like broadest possible, you would say like these are the only things it applies to. And they use this for bioinformatics because you were talking about like the whole part where you patent a person is bad. And so for bioinformatics patents, you have to clearly prescribe what you're covering and what you're not. And you have to say what you're going to implement so we know you're not making like pig babies or something. So I'm saying there's some historical background on that being doable. Allowing more resources for software, like we said, the overpaid underwork thing where like now each particular application is like 18 hours or something over the course of like 2 years of attention from the patent examiner. And some of that is like admin stuff like, you're so-and-so, I didn't get page 17, could you please do that? You know, so allotting more resources for looking at software. Right now we assume a patent is valid until we can prove that it's not valid, but we could put the burden of proof on the patent applicant. And then the FTC, who have written like several 300-page reports about the problem of software patents and trolls, they're aware of it. They also don't know what they could do, but it's possible that we could go help them and try and figure out something useful that they could do. And then we're very close to the end here, so. So community solutions, like, screw all the politicians. Freedom is intrigued. What is, but it's a lot of work. So community solutions means us doing some work, right? So I work at the Open Invention Network, which is a defensive patent pool, and so everyone cross-licenses and agrees to not sue each other. So it doesn't affect, like, patents outside of the pool. It's very targeted on like Linux, GNU, like other specific like free software stuff around the Linux operating system and a couple of like, and the Android system and a couple of web service things. So we also, yeah.
How is the Open Invention Network financed?
So it's six large companies that make a lot of money out of GNU Linux, and they would like for smaller companies that share the same technology to not get sued and create poor legal precedent. So they opened up and said, we'll fund this, please cross-license and try to not get sued on stuff that they're going to come after us for in a year or two. So that's the short, you know. Identifying relevant prior art. This worked pretty well for the railroad industry. Like the guy with no trains, as it turned out, didn't have any of the prior art for train brakes. So they were able to knock out a lot, invalidate a lot of the patents that were plaguing the railroad industry. We run a website in concert with a couple other folks called the Linux Defenders, which works on gathering prior art for the operating. So the DPL, this is like Google has been looking at this, the sticky and non-sticky. It's still in beta. They're still working on how to write this. They've been calling it the GPL for patents. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but that was here. So it's a community license. You basically would say like, you can use all my patents if I can use all your patents. So it's similar to the defensive pool, but it's a little bit more complicated. And the sticky version means like patents can never leave the pool. And then the non-sticky, it's kind of, maybe it's like the LGPL for patents or something. Patents can leave the pool. They can be in for a while, and then you can take them out later. And like I said, this is still in beta. But that also means like Google is interested in hearing from people about it. Like if you have ideas, you're like, oh, I know it would make that work. Like, they want to hear from you. I think continuing to build awareness and draw attention to the problem. One of the reasons that I think like getting Congress to do anything about this is because for us, we all know like software patents. But other people hear about software patent suits and like they're like, you know, Apple and Microsoft and Samsung all suing each other, like cry me a river. Those guys have like 50 houses. I don't care if they get sued the pants off of them. So letting people know that that's not the only victim of the problem with software patents. So, all right, and I think this, I have this up on a slide share type thing. But so free reading pleasure, and those are the picture credits. And then I think we have like 2 minutes for questions. I'm sorry. Okay. Here and then here. Okay.
So everyone I know talks about software as a language. Why does it fall under patent law and not copyright?
Right. Okay. So copyright, for folks that are not aware, is traditionally applied to like music, poems, movie, like language type things. Software for a long time, so like the GPL rests on copyright. So that's like the written part of the software. So you could, the way that software works, I assume most people at least somewhere else of this, is that you could write two very different programs that accomplish the same function. So the patent is on the function, not the specific text that you use to achieve it.
Well, with software, the function is
always usability.
Right.
It's always one and zero.
Right, but you could still, so like, you know, I might do a do while and you might do a for loop and then like feed it in a different order or whatever. So like, but we're getting the same thing to happen, even if we're not using, like, even if you didn't use the same order of loops or like maybe you're, like, oh, I like to do everything with recursion, and I'm like, oh, that's just a pain in the butt, I'm never using it. Like, but we are able to get to the same place. So you could have copyright on the way that you wrote your program, right? But you can't have copyright on the function. That would be under patent law if you chose to get a patent. So, next.
Is anybody talking about, at sort of a technical level, doing something like with patents, saying you have to commercialize the use of that patent, you know, embody it in a real product within, say, 3 or 5 years, or you lose the patent altogether.
That would be a good one.
That would definitely get to the troll problem. I haven't seen that concept written yet, so I don't know why it hasn't been thought of. Maybe you could write a paper on it. I think the thing is then, like, it might be difficult to say implementing, because then, you know, with 1,300 shell companies, you might be able to get somebody to sell, like, a single item or something. So you might end up with, like, anything that kind of attempts to get the troll thing. Like, I don't know if you caught, but they're very tricksy. So, like, to make sure that there's not, like, just a way to, like, kind of wheeze. It's like how they get standing in Texas always. Usually one person using the software in that district to get standing to sue in that district. So it's like, it has to be pretty ironclad. So if we did that, we'd have to figure out a way to word it that was pretty ironclad. I'm gonna go way in the back and then over here.
I feel like the process itself is where, like, the getting people to sue less seems like just the band-aid on the broken initial process.
Sure.
Because I'm wondering if there's like, a simple language requirement in patent applications that like within 5 sentences you have to prove to me that this isn't ridiculous, you know, kind of thing, and like basic. It sort of takes some of the pressure off of the patent people. Like, is there a way to raise the?
Yeah, so I think actually the thing where they would have to limit scope and talk about implementation is similar to that idea, and that's basically saying, like, you have to show me that you have, like, that you know how this would be implemented, not just that you have an idea with a goal. And the definiteness where you kind of prescribe the boundary. So that's a little legalese, but I think it's getting at the same thing of being like, can we just ask them to not have dumb patents?
Well, I think like a simple language approach may have a simpler outcome.
Oh, yeah, well, and that's for a couple different audiences. Like, there's legal language on the inside, but then if we were to work on, like, an advocacy piece of it, I think we would come up with something better than definiteness or whatever. So, like, I agree, like, in order to push any kind of policy change, we would need, like, a good, normal, regular person language version of, like, what is trying to happen. So, I mean, that's the case anytime you try to pass a law, like, people don't really want to read like a 40-page law. I mean, some people do, and that's awesome. I'm glad. But when we're talking to the public, like anyone who's read EFF stuff, like I'm sure they have a very complex like legalese version of what they're trying to do when they're doing lobbying, and then they have like a nice 2-sentence like so that we know like, okay, you're the good guys, awesome. Please keep doing the good stuff. Does that kind of speak to?
No, but that's okay.
Okay, sorry. And you had your hand up here, and then I don't know.
If there's general agreement that the patent process, big idea-wise, is generally good, if I create something brand new, I should have some reward for doing that, be protected from people just copying me.
Mm-hmm.
And software can be broken down to just being entirely math.
Right.
Any software breaking down the math.
Mm-hmm.
If there are no search engines, and I invent the next Google, it's a brand new thing, under kind of the general gist of what we've been talking about, that wouldn't be patentable at all. But it's a brand new thing. What part of that would I be protected on if I were to patent that process? Or should I be protected on? There's one side of the argument that says that all software patents are a bad thing,
mm-hmm.
or should not be allowed because they're math. On the other side of it, I just created something brand new,
mm-hmm.
that it feels like, in the general gist of patents at large,
right.
I should have some protection.
What right.
protections actually should I have, do you think? In what cases do you think that software patents are a good idea?
Right, so that gets down to like a moral question. And I would say, some people believe that there shouldn't be any software patents whatsoever. I'm closer to that end, but only because there's so much abuse on that side. I definitely think that if you invented the next search engine, it depends on if you actually know how to make it. Like, if you're just like, there ought to be a thing for looking stuff up on the web.
Yeah,
like, you shouldn't be able to pet
things to look stuff up, and I create it and say, here,
right.
I give this to you.
So then you would need to kind of describe all the steps in that, mm-hmm. to say, like, okay, so, like, I use a database, I use a giant server, I have, mm-hmm. like, this lovely user interface, and I have this, like, predictive, like, autofill thing. So you would name all of those specific functions, and perhaps that's worth patenting, but not just saying, like, I do this thing on a computer. So do you know what I mean? Like, it's so, like, having some specificity, because it's...
Well, yeah, I could specify that, but I could also say, well, you specified this, but it's all a program. Therefore,
right.
it is all math. Therefore, I can copy you because I am copying math.
Yeah, and that might just... Yeah, it's supposed to be on the functionality. So, like, it wouldn't be on your code, but I know what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't know enough about how search engines actually work under the hood.
Neither
it's
do
like
I.
How
I
much of it is math and how much of it is a little bit of, like, the arrangement and application. But, patents are, it's not on the written stuff, it's on the function. It's supposed to be, and then, like, because of the way that software works and it's confusing to many people, we ended up, like, opening a giant door, and you can just say, like, anything, comma, on a computer. And then that's patentable. So, okay. And I guess this is the last talk of the day. I don't know if there was, okay. All right. There was nothing else, I don't know, since they're not kicking us out, but. Oh.
This is going off the topic, but it started relates to the patent. Software company can prevent you from reselling the software you bought. Is there anything that's trying to extend to have to try to overcome that? I buy a book, I can resell.
Mm-hmm.
I can't sell a copy of it, but I can sell the book.
That kind of gets to how your software is licensed. So if you're using free software, then you are always guaranteed the right to share it out. And I would say do business with software companies that respect you and allow you to share with your neighbor.
A lot of times you're not buying software, you're
trying
to use the software.
Yeah, that's proprietary.
But as soon as you buy it.
I want to just thank people for coming, because I know a lot of people would like to leave and they don't want to feel rude while we're still chatting, but thank you for coming.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever consider recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HBR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.